submit it for your consideration. Man has always challenged nature, thinking that they contain the elements. But what happens when nature changes the rules and fights back? This is a Nature vs. Man 2 for one literary license podcast episode, exploring science fiction and horror, and weighing the outcomes of a dying planet, with your co-hosts, Keith Chalko, John Wilson, Vicky Ray, and Jesse Fultz. Man will forever be changed.
Welcome to the Digital License Podcast, and it's our Nature versus Man episode, where we're going to be discussing Mad Max from 1979 and Mad Max and Fury Road from 2015. And before we get started, let's find out who's with us. We have special guest C. Derek Miller, or Chad. Hello.
How's it going? Good to be back.
Going good. And we have Joe Rendazzo. Hello, Joe.
Hey, everyone. Glad to be back as well.
And John Wilson's back for his normal monthly episode. Hello, John.
Hi, folks.
And I'm Keith Shaw. Before we get started, let's find out what we've been up to. So starting with Chad, what have you been up to since last time we spoke to you?
Man, I have been dodging bullets from the release of my splatter western, Starving Zoe, with Death's Head Press. It's been a very divisive novella, actually. It's touched some people in the wrong places. But it's touched some people in the right places, too, because it's selling like hotcakes. I'm really enjoying it. So. Working on a Netflix series right now with a retired Fox producer. So hopefully things will go well there.
That's great.
Good news. What about yourself, Joe? What have you been up to?
Finished a couple of screenplays, and lately I started a couple more, and I've just been, for whatever reason, I've just been in the mood to just watch a lot of Hammer films. So I've been doing that like late at night. I'm up till 3-4 in the morning watching like 2 or 3 Hammer films every day. And I've been in the mood for it. So I've just kind of been binging those. And last night was up late watching The Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires. So I've been kind of just enjoying my time off.
And what about yourself, John?
I have been in the throes of trying to buy a place in Jersey, and it's such a fun process, I say with so much sarcasm. when I'm not, you know, pulling my hair out, trying to figure the numbers out, I have caught up with WandaVision. Actually, no, I have one episode now because it's so funny how people hate it at the beginning, and now people are like, oh my God, this show is amazing. I'm like, how did you pivot so quickly? And I've also been playing Phoenix Immortals Rising, which is a very fun Greek mythology, almost like Breath of the Wild type game. Really, really fun. You would love it, Keith. I don't know if you played it yet, but it's almost kind of like what I've been told. It's like Valhalla and God of War and Breath of the Wild like combined together as a game. Okay. It's really fun. And they have all these expansion packs coming out. I just finished it, but then there's like 3 different characters and stories that are, so for the first time, I think they're actually going to evolve this into other different types of platforms in order for you to play in sort of the Greek, Roman, and then you have like ancient samurai, like gods and wars and all that type of thing too. So bringing that in. So fun.
And myself, I'm starting on the whole campaign of promoting my game that's out on the 21st of June, 2021. Woo! Buy it on all platforms, Xbox, yay, PlayStation, everywhere. Back for Blood. So I start that. I got a bunch of interviews. I got being interviewed by Xbox Magazine and PlayStation Magazine this weekend. So
nice. Congratulations.
I think I'm just going to wing it. Let's see what kind of crap comes out of my mouth there.
Those are the best interviews. Yeah,
that's quite cool. But besides that, not much really. Just want to say thank you to Anna and the Apocalypse for giving us a shout out for apparently our podcast has helped. We weren't the main reason, but we helped get them on Netflix in the UK, going on the US Netflix next month, and internationally the month after that.
Yay!
So Anna and the Apocalypse, awesome, can be found on Netflix. So congratulations.
Woo-hoo! It also helps that it's a damn good movie.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I hope it actually helps them relight a fire there, because I hope that they do a sequel or a prequel or something fun. You know.
Well, what they were talking when I talked to Barry a couple weeks ago, he was basically stating that because it's getting quite a little cult following. It's only been on a couple weeks, and it's actually in their top 10 over here already. And Netflix is now looking back at it as being a series. So that might be back on the boards for them.
That'd be fun. I also was like, I don't know if I mentioned this on our podcast, but it'd be interesting is, you know how Anna was always wanting to go to Australia. Remember the beginning was her trying to leave to go. It'd be hysterical that they kind of get this under control and they go to Australia and this happens again, and do a whole series about her. Like, oh God, not again. Like this happened again, you know, Anna on vacation. What are, you know?
Well, the composers have now signed another contract for the second series of the new Animaniacs series, because I guess they were quite impressed by their music that they wrote for the new series, that they've now signed them for another series. And so that's quite good. So they're quite happy. And besides that,
Depp jokes.
Excuse me?
Just try to avoid the Johnny Depp jokes.
And I think, well, other than that, I've been watching. I actually started watching Vampire Diaries. I've avoided it for like the play, because I thought it was a bit more like Twilight. So that's the reason I was avoiding it. But I actually was quite impressed. I'm actually quite digging it at the moment. So
nice.
Enjoying that. WandaVision, I've been watching that. I have to be like most of the other people. I'm not a Marvel fan. I'm not a Marvel comic book person. So I didn't know who these characters were. So I went into Wanda quite cold. And that's what they say after the first two or three episodes, and once it hit that after that point, and then I did a little bit of research about what this is about, and then all of a sudden it's like I got into it. So, but I'm actually really enjoying it. So I'm glad I stuck with it.
Yay. It was the same. I've always been more of a DC fan than Marvel, with the exception of maybe the Wolverine. And I really didn't know who these characters were, and I went into it blind, but just tried to keep an open mind, because I'd heard through spoilers that it was a little wacky in the beginning, and I haven't watched today's episode either. I'm in the same boat with you.
Yeah.
But everything I've seen so far is fan freaking tastic. I think between that and The Mandalorian, Disney Plus is going to continue to get my money for a very long time.
I'm looking forward to like Loki looks really good. It looks like different. And then there's a series, an animated series called What If, and it's like, it's all these different scenarios of like, what if Captain actually died and Agent Carter becomes Captain America, but she goes back to London, and she's like, so it's all these what if scenarios of anime, which looks really good.
I've been asking myself why I keep Netflix, and I'm kind of sort of working for them, so maybe that's a good idea.
I mean, I, for me, Netflix still pulls it out of the bag. I think for me, the weaker of all, I think the online ones probably has Amazon. They still got a long way to go.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for The Boys, I probably would have not be watching it. Dark Shadows, because we are covering that in our podcast. And though I have all of them on DVD, it's just so much easier just to stream it than get the DVDs out, start sliding them into the machine sort of thing.
Right.
Which is more of my laziness. But Disney Plus over here in the UK is now bringing on Hulu and Stars as part of the package with no extra cost. So that was quite good over here.
That's nice.
Yeah. So so we'll be able to have the X-Files on streaming and all the other classics. They seem to be
expanding
in this country.
There's a movie on Netflix I forgot to mention too that I watched called A Monster Calls, and I remember seeing like a brief trailer about it. It is so good, and it's gut-wrenching. By the end of it, I was sobbing. I told my friend, thank you so much for making me watch this movie, because I'm now bawling my eyes out. But it's such a fantastic movie. It's about a boy, and he gets visited by this big monster, and he tells him three stories, but then he makes the child tell, it's almost like Never Ending Story in a way, the way it's told, but the animation to it and the way the themes to it. I mean, just check it out if you have time. It's really, really well done.
Where is that?
It's on Netflix. I feel like I know the mom who's in it, who the actress. I have to go back and look who it is, but it's unfamiliar actors. The only one you'll know is Sigourney Weaver, who plays the mom of her. And it's again, it's just fantastic. It's such a great story. It's also what I recommend parents have their kids watch. And it's a really hard film to watch or have your children watch, but there's a reason behind it. I don't want to give anything away, but it's really well done.
I'll go check that out. I'm looking forward to checking that out. I haven't seen any WandaVision yet. I'm just going to wait for the whole thing. And then I want to check out that Cecil Hotel documentary also. Because that whole hotel is always just kind of, having lived in LA, it kind of always creeped me out, the history behind it. Like you're hearing like people call the paramedics just so they can stab them in the hallway. There's no fucking reason, but that I got to check that out too. But yeah, I'm going to add that to my list too.
I have to sit there and say that I watched it with my two housemates, and I sit there at the very beginning. It's like about the girl. It starts about the girl, and I basically solved it. I go, oh, it's because of this. And by the end of it, they all looked at me like, how did you know that? I go, hey, it's what I was trained to do. it's very, very interesting. But, you know, then I guess, you know, with a hotel with that kind of history, once you realize what's going on around that area, it kind of all starts making sense as well. So it's quite interesting.
So wait, the Elisa Lam case got solved?
Yeah.
It did? Oh, I never knew it did. Yeah. All right, cool. I'll watch the documentary. I followed it when it first happened, and then I never figured. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Once you realize, you know, without giving anything, once you realize the reasoning behind it and what happened, it all makes sense. It all's like, oh, okay, this all makes sense, sort of thing. And besides that, I've been watching a lot of Asian horror series on Netflix at the moment. Sweet Home, if you like creatures and monsters and gore, watch it. It's fantastic. And Alice in Borderlands, excellent as well. And both are coming back for a second season, so that's quite good.
Nice.
Well, that brings us to our first film, which is Mad Max, which is a 1979 Australian dystopian action thriller film directed by George Miller and produced by Byron Kennedy. Mel Gibson stars as Mad Max Rockstansky, a police officer turned vigilante in a near future Australia in the midst of societal collapse. Joanne Samuel, Hugh Keys Burns, Steve Bisley, Tim Burns, and Roger Ward also star. Jane McCausland and Miller wrote the screenplay with a story by Miller and Kennedy. Principal photography of Mad Max took place in and around Melbourne and lasted 6 weeks. The film initially received a polarized reception upon its release in April 1979. Although it won 4 AACTA awards and attracted a cult following, its critical reputation has grown since. Filmed on a budget of $400,000, has earned more than $100 million worldwide, U.S. dollars, in gross revenue, and holds the Guinness record for most profitable independent film of all times, beating out Halloween by $50 million.
Wow.
The success of Mad Max has been credited for further openings of a global market to Australian New Wave films. The film became the first in Mad Max series, giving rise to the three sequels, Mad Max 2, Beyond Thunderdome from 1985, and Fury Road, which we'll be covering later, in 2015. In 2020, a fifth film, to be titled Furiosa, has now gone into pre-production. What we'll do is cut to the trailer of Mad Max and be right back.
Tomorrow, in a world gone mad, the only law will be a renegade squad of suicidal cops.
He's my prisoner, and he's not walking out that door.
And the open road will be controlled by gangs of glory roaders. Max is a cop, one of the best.
Where does it run to get you? Scoot jockeys? Yeah, nomad trash. Well, I'll add it to my thread collection.
He was awaiting you made the news again. Charges relating to the slaying of a main force patrol officer. Who was he?
In a road blockade accident. Just another glory roader, I guess.
Toe Cutter is a glory roader, one of the most sadistic.
Anything I say, anything you say, what a wonderful philosophy you have. Take him away.
I want my baby.
You've not got a sense of humor.
Please don't hurt my baby.
You've got a pretty face, though.
Both want the other dead. but only one can have his way. Mad Max. You don't want to make Max mad. Because when Max gets mad, he gets even. American International presents Mad Max, the maximum force of the future.
Hello, welcome to Literary Legends Podcast, and we're discussing Mad Max from 1979. So, Chad, what are your thoughts about Mad Max from 1979?
Well, I had never seen the original Mad Max until about a month ago. I grew up with Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. That was probably came out when maybe I was 11, 12 years old, something along those lines. It was the first thing that introduced me to Mel Gibson. First thing that introduced me to Tina Turner, and just blown away. Had no idea really what was going on. Just knew it was a post-apocalyptic thing. Love Beyond Thunderdome, but I've never seen the original until about a month ago. And just, I'm not sure what happens between those two movies, but they're night and day.
Yeah.
I know the Road Warrior happens between them, and I've never seen the Road Warrior. It's in my to watch things here in the near future. But I doubt very seriously that everything that happens between point A and point B takes place in that movie. So I guess it was just the beginning of the collapse of society in the first Mad Max, which I just personally lived through in Dallas, Texas. If you guys have watched the news, it would have been a lot more interesting if there were roving gangs of village people cosplayers. So there were not.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Snowpocalypse 2021 Texas did not have that. But, I liked it. I liked it for what it was worth. I tried to put myself into the mindset of someone in a theater in 1979 viewing this movie for the very first time. I could see where it gained its cult following. I can see where it was very mind-blowing to a casual cinema goer at that time. And I'm actually very curious now to see the next one in the series. I'm very, very curious to see The Road Warrior, to see what happens between Mad Max and Beyond Thunderdome to make it what it is. But yeah, very, very good. Very, very fond memories of Mel Gibson in the 80s compared to now.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny that because when I first was watching, I too am in the same bucket as you. I never really watch. I've never been one to watch like what I call road rage like films. So I'm not a big Fast and the Furious. I'm not a big like, oh, cars, you know, like I'm not. I get it, but at the same time, it's like I never got into that. And so watching this, I was a little thrown off. And part of it was obviously the slang that Australians use versus what Americans use. And even talk about, I was reading about doing a little, you know, research on my own. They're saying how they had to create an American version versus Australian because some of the slang would throw you off. I felt like it was very.
You don't know what a skag is, then.
You don't know what a skag is.
A skag is. A skag.
Oi! I can't believe that. That's hey. I'm like, okay, at least I know that. At least, come on, oi! You know, I found it to be more like bohemian than post-apocalyptic. If you know, because it seemed very carefree. It didn't seem like everyone was like hunkering down or afraid. The only time they were afraid was when this crew came into town. It was like, it's very Western in a way. It's like everyone's chilling out in the town. All of a sudden,
it was post-apocalyptic with a budget.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What about yourself, Joe? What are your thoughts?
Similar to Chad, I was kind of thinking when I'm watching this, I watched Fury Road earlier in the day. And then I went back and after work watched Mad Max, and it's also like watching those two in particular. It is like night and day, like you said, because the first one, like John said, it didn't seem that post-apocalyptic. It's just kind of like a modern for its time Western. So yeah, if you watch just those two movies without Beyond Thunderdome and without the Road Warrior. It makes you what the hell got us from here to here? Because it's obviously, yeah, there's a couple things that are obviously kind of falling apart in Mad Max, but not to the level of what of Fury Road. It's like the old Toby Hooper thing. He said he knows it's a good screenplay when he reads the first page and the last page and goes, how the hell did that happen?
Yeah.
So if you watch just those two movies, you want to go back and watch those two middle ones and go, how did it get from here? Which it's just, a gang crime Western to this place where society's completely destroyed and decimated. It was interesting rewatching it because I hadn't seen the first Mad Max in like a solid maybe 20 years or so.
Well, basically, I am a fan of all the Max as they were coming out. And basically, I guess what you have is the first one is more of a realistic view of what you have sort of thing. And what you have is the Mad Max character and his society breaks down. And what's been, studied in like with things like Nietzsche and Schoenberg is that, first of all, law gets broken down. Then after law breaks down, and this is the reason why this film came about is another thing is that, and I don't know if any of you remember, but there was the energy crisis of 1974. Where gas and everything were basically, and people were actually fist fighting and shooting people at gas stations in America and Australia, around the world, because they couldn't get gas for their cars. So this kind of spurred off this sort of thing. And that's why you'll notice when you do get to the second one, and Thunderdome goes a bit further, and then, of course, Fury Road goes a bit further with that, is that gas is a commodity where human life is nothing. And it gets to be, so when you start getting the breakdown of society, what happens is law breaks down first, and then the lawlessness take over the land. And so no matter how you want to stay out of it, there's nothing to keep you out of it. That you're going to be snuck down the middle, you're going to fight to survive, or you're going to die sort of thing. And that's what we kind of get with Mad Max sort of situation, is that we have the breakdown of law. That's the reason why when you do see the Hall of Justice and the police, everything's the offices and everything are all in disarray. There's no form of justice. People are quitting the law force over and over and over. Kind of, I guess if you're going to make it into a modern day science fiction, it probably closely resembles RoboCop, when lawlessness started taking over, that sort of thing. And they need, we're corporations, but here you don't have the corporations coming in. You're kind of on your own sort of thing.
Yeah.
And an interesting thing about Mad Max as far as society breakdowns are concerned is that if you do compare it to countries where society has broken down before civil war and stuff like this, this is kind of thing that's happened. But yeah, it does, like as John says, it does fit the Western prototype where, man loses everything. He fights back to get what's his, and then he goes on the lonesome road. And then, of course, with Mad Max 2, you get 8 years later, of what's happening, and basically society is totally broken down. And then Thunderdome is broken down even further, and it's lawless. And basically you have your groups that are forming the law of their land in their groups. So it's either going to be part of a group and you can survive no matter if you agree with the laws that you found yourself in, or you're going to be a lone wolf and you're going to be on your own and you're everyone's enemy at that point.
Yeah.
But I think what's interesting, I guess if these films were made today, I think what you probably would have Road Warrior made first, and then you would have a prequel done, which would have been this film, and it probably would have been spiced up a little bit more. Yeah. But because we have something a bit more organically put together with these, what's quite interesting about the Mad Max films, that they're all directed and written by one director and writer.
Yeah, that's impressive. Yeah. That doesn't happen anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And another thing, I guess, if you remember George Miller, if you look at his other films, whether it's Gallipoli, which is another huge film, which I think is Mel Gibson's first film that was internationally acclaimed. And then you look at his other films, whether it's Babe or Happy Feet and the other films, they all have an ecological, but they all have an ecological message that flows through all his films.
Yeah.
That's the sort of thing. So he's kind of the man that had his pulse on, environmental collapse from the very beginning, probably before it was cool and trendy.
I love a director, though, who can go from one side of the spectrum to the other. He can go from a talking pig to post-apocalyptic Carnage. You know, it's like Robert Rodriguez. Robert Rodriguez does the same stuff. You know, you've got From Dusk Till Dawn, and you've got Spy Kids, and
yeah.
And was that Lava Boy and Shark Girl?
Right.
I mean, another thing I quite like, I mean, there's some, another thing that Mad Max harbors back to as well is you have to remember that in the 70s, we also had grindhouse films that were quite big at this time. And the art and these postmodern art films are coming out, whether it was Liquid Sky and all these other films that were kind of bubbling underneath this. And so what we kind of got is got a mixture of these kind of post-punk kind of films, but we do have the organic car chases as well, which were very big, whether, you know, and, you know, Quentin Tarantino gave a nod to these in his short, well, his mini film of Death Proof, you know, whether it was, you know, was Electric Glide and Blue and some of the other car films that were coming out at that time. So this was kind of in there. But the interesting thing is that the motorcycle gang that you are watching in this film are actually a real motorcycle gang.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That I didn't know.
I was reading too that a lot of it, because they were trying to be so just quick with the shooting, that a lot of they didn't close down the roads. And so they were just kind of shooting and then they'd go back and like redust the roads. But then eventually law enforcement found out about how ironic, in the sense that there in Australia, they're like, this is fun, let's help you. And like in versus America, they'd be like, we're going to fine you. We're going to permit you, you know, like there. And so that's kind of cool. Like everything was off the cuff, you know, they did it quickly and shot quickly, but you wouldn't be able to tell that watching it now. I was like, wow, that's kind of amazing to be able to do that. Cause it does seem like in that aspect, it does seem like a barren land, cause there's not that many people. There's like little villages that they see, and they, you know, the seaside village with the couple, you know, the town. I would say what was interesting too, is just the interactions with people, that it almost felt a little Grease, like just the way the mannerisms and how they look at each other, how they react to each other, like, you know, how they pull the guy and they're joshing the guy and his girlfriend, then they get in the car and they take off and then they chase them. It felt very 60s that way, like, you know, the style.
I think another thing that's quite interesting is that all the cars that were mangled, not the police cars, but the other cars that were mangled, were basically the director's own car, like the van. Is what they did. They didn't have a car, so they used the director's van and they smashed that. The trailer was one of the stunt guy's trailer that he just bought, and they go, we need this for the film. And all the crashes basically that you see are real crashes. I mean,
one of the most painful is when they destroy that car, that beautiful car. And I was like, oh god, can you imagine being the person who owned that car? And it's like, we're gonna just destroy it. You're like, oh. And I also love the different types of, like, there was that, like, the bike that wasn't a bike, but it was like a three wheeler. Like, I love like the different, that kind of aspect of it was you had, you know, the police officer's car, and then you had Max's car towards the end. And then you had different types of, you know, vehicles throughout this that were like, you know, very cool.
And interesting fact of this is that the woman who plays the wife in the movie, she's the second actress. The first actress got badly injured and was in the hospital for 8 weeks.
Oh yeah.
She actually got run over by the motorcycle.
Oh my god.
Yeah,
so like, oh, we gotta retake this one.
we need to recast her.
Let me guess, was this a scene when she gets ran over by the bike and did they film that and it literally was her?
And there's also 20 minutes of this film that's been cut due to another thing that a lot of people don't know, because people have an idea of what Australia is as far as censorship goes, but they're actually heavily more censored than America and the UK about certain things. And so that's and then they had to cut 20 minutes out of it because of the censorship in Australia, and they lost all that footage.
No.
I was wondering that, because there are some that they almost get you there, but then they don't show, like, for instance, the woman who's brutalized and, you know, the guy who gets like, you know, taken out, whatever. And then the woman is brutalized and all that, but they kind of, you kind of skip, like, you don't see that. You kind of see the aftermath of that, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's that. I think you had the running over the child.
Yeah.
Close up.
Right.
He also had the rape of the guy and the rape of the woman going simultaneous and stuff like that.
And then the burn too, his friend who got heavily burned. I'm sure they tried to show something of a degree of that.
Mm-hmm. You know, watching these films, does anybody else feel cheated by our own pandemic now? Where are the car chases? Everybody, instead of, you know, like rising up to be this huge villain or this huge hero, everyone's like, this is hard. Everything's hard. I feel cheated.
I feel like everyone wanted either a zombie apocalypse or like this type of like post-apocalyptic world where some warlord is going to come and be like, I control all of the internet now.
Okay, just give it time. I think that's coming.
Yeah, exactly.
It's still early. We're less than a year in.
Yeah.
It's still early.
They're plotting, you know.
Could you imagine that if COVID hit us like the 80s? Then they'd really be bitching.
Seriously. Like,
well, nothing to watch, nothing to do. Like,
yeah.
You know, trying to call someone, but you have to wait because you're on a party line.
Oh, man. My internet dial-up is...
Actually, I think if COVID happened in the 80s, I was telling a patient the other day, if COVID happened in the 80s and the family next door had COVID, my mom would probably send us all over there to play with them.
So we get
it over with.
You'll be fine.
You'll be fine. You'll live to see another day. Let's just get it over with. Sort of thing. But I think what's interesting about Mad Max, I think it's quite interesting to see because it's very rare that you get the beginnings of an apocalyptic film. You normally kind of go, you're kind of somewhere between the middle going towards the end of an apocalyptic
film.
You never see the beginning stages of something. And I thought that's probably the reason what keeps Mad Max alive is that this is probably one of the only films you actually see the very beginning of it.
Yo, you're absolutely correct. And I didn't look at this film that way until you said that. As we were speaking just now, it's the beginning of the... I can't think of another apocalyptic movie that shows you the beginning. They'll take you right into the middle of it and then give you a little bit of backstory through some flashbacks or something. But you're absolutely right. And as far as the breakdown of law, I think that what you called it, the Hall of Justice, because I remember announcing to the living room, meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
All I kept thinking was like DC, you know, one Roman and Batman are going to come flying out of it.
Yes. but the set used for the Hall of Justice was one of the most worn out sets used in the whole film, really. You know, everything else kind of looked like a you know, maybe small town in the middle of nowhere, New England. You know, well, I've never been to Australia, so I can only use the places in the United States as an example. But I've seen a lot of little towns like that in the middle of nowhere, New England, sometimes in the deep, deep South. But the Hall of Justice was just beat the hell up. It was run down. It looked like apocalypse, but everything else looked all right.
I sit there and say that Australia is kind of a weird place anyway. You have your big cities are on the outside, whether it's Melbourne or Sydney. And then as you go into the outback, it's very far and in between. And it's a lot like Wolf Creek. Have you ever seen the movie Wolf Creek or Wolf Creek 2? That's pretty much the outback. And this is pretty much the land that we're dealing with here in Mad Max sort of thing. And it is quite lawless as well. Basically, if you get stuck out there in the middle of nowhere, you're pretty much on your own sort of thing.
So. Now, I've been to places in Wyoming that are like that. Wyoming is just strange. It's basically the population of Rhode Island spread out over a huge area. If you wreck out there, you're done for. Deer are going to gang up on you and eat you in the street, which is a great premise for a Mad Max sequel, actually. I don't know if George is listening. George, if you're listening, we have ideas.
Deer and headlights.
So does anyone have anything more to add about Mad Max before we move to the next one?
I mean, I like that they set up the, they set up for the child being run over at the end, right at the beginning, by kind of having the tease right in that initial chase. And you sit there wondering, would they do it? But now, and you don't even think of it. If you're watching this for the first time, you don't think, would they actually run over a child? They established, yes, they would. And you never think that they're actually going to do it at the end of the movie, that the gang's actually going to do it. And they're right at the end, run down the wife and kid. So they set that up at the beginning, which, again, having watched Fury Road earlier that day, you kind of knew that it was coming. But I like that they set up and pay off like that.
Yeah, and also, I never understood, and I know we're not discussing this film, but it's the one that I've seen the most, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, when they're in the Thunderdome and they get the helmet off of Master Blaster. And there's a moment of recognition from Max as he looks at, I don't know if he was Master or Blaster, the big guy. Like he sees his face with the helmet off, and there's a moment of recognition. Is that not the same guy in the woods in this one? Am I just thinking into this too much?
I'm not quite sure, because I know what you're talking about, and I know, and the guy has Down syndrome, doesn't he?
Yes.
And
that's what makes yes.
Max not him. And that's when it gets Tina Turner get kind of pissed off, I guess, is the word of that. You're supposed to kill Master Blaster sort of thing in her Tina Turner tones. But it could be. I mean, the thing is, because you're never quite because society has moved so far from the beginning of, you know, from this film, it's kind of hard to figure out, because George Miller has a habit of using these characters again. I mean, Goose is used again in Rogue Warrior and again in Thunderdome as different characters,
yeah,
sort of thing, but all kind of the same character, but in another being, another Asian, character name, yeah. Sort of thing. Because, but there's more of a joining up of the series with Mad Max 2 and Beyond Thunderdome, and Fury Road actually does. These are actually, when you go from two to four, you'll see that they blend up a lot closer. And then they become more of a futuristic, apocalyptic version of Clint Eastwood's spaghetti westerns. They become like that, the man with no name, except this one, his name's Max sort of thing, but it very rarely goes by Max. And you'll notice in Fury Road, they very rarely mention his name. So I guess that brings us to Mad Max Fury Road, which is a 2015 Australian post-apocalyptic action film co-written, co-produced, and directed by George Miller. Miller collaborated with Brendan McCarthy and Nico Lotharis on the screenplay, the fourth installment and a revisiting of the Mad Max franchise. It was produced by Kennedy Miller Mitchell and Rat Pack Doom and Entertainment, and distributed by Village Roadshow Pictures in Australia and by Warner Brothers Pictures internationally. The film stars Tom Hardy, Charlize Theron, Nicholas Holt, Hugh Keyes Bain, Rosie Huntington-Whiteley, Riley Q, Zoe Kravitz, Abby Lee, and Courtney Eaton. The film is set in post-apocalyptic desert wasteland where petrol and water are scarce commodities, and follows Max Rockin' Stansky, as I spit this out, who joins forces with Imperator Furiosa to flee from cult leader Immortal Joe and his army in an armored tanker truck, leading to a lengthy road battle. Fury Road was in developmental hell for many years, with pre-production starting as early as 1997. Attempts to shoot the film in 2001 and 2003 were delayed due to September 11th attacks and the Iraq War. In 2007, after focusing on the animated comedy Happy Feet, Miller decided to pursue it again. He briefly considered producing Fury Road as a computer animated film, but abandoned it in favor of live action. In 2009, Miller announced that filming would begin in early 2011. Hardy was cast as Max in June 2010, with production planned to begin that November. Principal photography was delayed several more times before beginning in July 2012. The film wrapped in December 2012, although additional footage was shot in November 2013. And as this film was trying to get into pre-production, it started off the Mad Max computer game, which has also did very, very well. Luckily, they were able to finish that by the time this film came out because of the long gestation periods. So, Joe, let's cut to the trailer and we'll get back to Mad Max Fury Road.
In this wasteland, I am the one who runs from both the living and the dead. A man reduced to a single instinct. Survive.
It is property!
Oh, what a day! What a lovely day!
Want to get through this?
Let's go!
As the world fell, each of us in our own way was broken. It was hard to know who was more crazy. Me, or everyone else.
Hello, welcome back to the Literary Lessons Podcast, and we're discussing Mad Max Fury Road from 2015. So, Joe, what are your thoughts about Mad Max Fury Road?
First, just wow. Because, when I went to see this in the theater, the trailers looked good, and, I figured it was going to be a fun little, post-apocalyptic action movie, and I wasn't prepared for just everything that the movie was. And it's rare. And it's almost sacrilege at times to say that the fourth film in a series is the best one in the series. But in this case, just everything in it, from the political subtext to the action sequences, the stunt work, the score, this is one of those movies where kind of like when we did Black Sabbath a couple months back, like this could turn into me gushing over it for like an hour. So, this is one of those movies where it's been in Miller's head. He knew what he wanted for so long that it came out basically perfect.
Yeah.
That's really the only praise I can give it without spoiling it for anybody who hasn't seen it. It's basically a perfect action post-apocalyptic movie, probably the best I've ever seen.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I mean, I saw Mad Max, and then I think the next day I watched this and I was like, holy hell, it's like night and day. What I would say is I definitely feel like this is more of a Furiosa movie than it is a yes. Mad Max. He is literally like the blood bag for Furiosa in the literal sense, because they use him to elevate sort of, the brand to elevate the exposure. And it's funny how I'm glad that it brought the audience to the film. I would have wanted more of, his story, because you get flashes of his story. But again, it was more about Furiosa and helping her get to where she needed to, and the five wives, if you will, to get them where they needed to. And it's just so beautifully, stunningly well done. I watched it, and then I had my friends watch it this past weekend and just said, you have to watch this film, because it's so... Because they were like, oh, what should we watch? I'm getting tired. I'm like, perfect film. You're not going to get tired during this film. You'll be wide awake. Trust me. And you're like, sure enough, right into the film, you're just in it and you're thrown in it. Everything is just so high octane, fast paced that you don't get a dull moment. And the other thing is, I just told my friends, suspend your disbelief, because there are moments in it that you're like, wait, how? And I'm like, just suspend your disbelief. Just go with it. Just go with it and go, we're in this post-apocalyptic world. There's tornadoes made of fire and all. Just go. Just go with it and let it go,
I mean, if I what I find quite interesting about Fury Road is that this is the first, you know, once you watch them all in context, you'll realize this is the first one that actually Mad Max is the narrator to. The other film, he's a legend, so it's always narrated by someone else. So this is the first time you actually get the Mad Max telling his story, because the other two films, Road Warrior, Mad Max 2, and Thunderdome, are told by another narrator. So it's their version of this man who's come to town to save them. Now we have a film said that's not actually, like you said, about Mad Max. It's about Mad Max narrating the story about this character he's helping, which is kind of a turn of events sort of thing. So which is quite interesting, because before it's all, because, you know, it's about the legend of Mad Max. And that's what you'll notice with the Mad Max films. They're about his legend, about who he is and how other people interpret him to be.
He's literally like the gunman that comes into town, does his thing, and then leaves. And it's so it is still that way, always a Western, if you will. It's like the good guy that comes into town. He kind of was forced to come into town. I think at that point in his life, he was trying to just avoid everyone. And like Keith, like you had mentioned in the first film, it's either you pick a side or you're going to always be hunted down by anyone. So he was at that point where I'm just going to try to do my own thing and try to avoid people as much as possible. A nomad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he did find himself, you know, thrown into the middle of a situation, didn't he? He couldn't really help.
Yeah.
I mean, when they tie you to the front of a car, they're using you as a hood ornament.
A blood bag. He was someone. A blood bag.
And they're chasing down after someone. And if you get away from that, you're kind of like at the mercy of whatever team you fall in front of, sort of thing.
Yeah. So. I also like to tie into the old religion, like the Valhalla and like all of that was like very cool. And just the oddities of it too, which I think it was such a refreshing thing, because, you know, you think of a world that's like a post-apocalyptic, that not too many people can be healthy if they're not getting food and, you know, nurturance. And like, there's this, you know, oddities where you see the people with the tattoos and the white skin and they have the tumors, and like all of that was like very cool and fresh in some ways. And that in the sense of the first film to here, like right now we are in this very transformed world where people are just trying to survive, you know?
And it does put a knock on things when, I mean, I guess this is where things like Walking Dead and the zombie apocalyptic movies kind of go wrong. Cause the thing is, if everything goes down, the first thing that you're going to be without is fresh water.
Yeah, exactly. It seemed like that must have been a dam at some point, because the way he's able to control the water is like the dam that would have been there. It's gone now. It's just a duct, a water duct.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, I mean, you know, if you don't have electricity and everything like that, you're not going to have fresh water.
That's true.
Yeah.
Was anyone else hesitant to watch this film for the first time like I was, though?
I would say I was a little bit like, oh God, is this going to be the overacting, like almost too much going on all at once that you just can't even focus on what's happening? Yeah, totally.
Like there were so many, like this came out 2015. There were so many movies in 2015 that were playing off of our 80s nostalgia. Like basically we're going to attempt to cater to middle-aged, you know, people and somehow put a spin on it that will get like the younger generations interested. And I was just so sick of that approach. Cause I mean, what else did we have that year? We had Ghostbusters with the all female cast. We had several others. So I really had no interest in seeing this at all, especially with the recasting of Max. I mean, not that Mel Gibson could still do what he was doing in the '80s today, but that just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. I did not give it a chance at all. I did not see it in a theater, and I kick myself in the ass every time I see this on my TV seeing it in a theater.
Well, I think that they wanted Mel Gibson initially, but what stopped it was his Jewish rant that kind of put the bosh on that, unfortunately.
Right.
Yeah. If that didn't happen, it probably would have been him, and it might have been a slightly different film.
Well,
I don't know if it'd be better or worse. I think it'd just be slightly have a different from, because I think Mel Gibson probably could still turn it in if he had to.
Did you see someone who did the dub face for it? That someone did a dub face of side by side of him. It's his face, but with Tom Harding's body, obviously. It's actually really cool and well done. I mean, if you go on YouTube, you can find it. And I was like, it's funny. I could see him. I don't know if his ego would have actually wanted this film because he's such a small character in this. Like, yeah, if you think about Mad Max character, even when you think at one point you're going to see him fight, you don't see him fight. Like, he goes into the cloud. They're like, where'd he go? I don't know. And then he comes back all bloody. You know, you don't even get to see any of that. You know he's a badass. You know he's capable of doing really cool things. But for the most part, like I said, this is Furiosa's film. Like, it's her trying to get to where she goes and all of that. So I think maybe his ego could have been a little bit like, there's not enough airtime for me, so I don't really know if I want to do this film. Like, in my opinion, like, I just think that at that point in your career,
I think with Mel Gibson is that I think that if they could get the money with his name attached, and that the whole thing didn't happen with him, the controversy that happened with him, I think he would have done it, because if it wasn't for George Miller, he wouldn't have a career.
Yeah,
I agree.
Gallipoli was brought into the masses as far as like being an actor. That was you know, that was a George Miller film. There's the Mad Max film that brought him to America, you know, and Road Warrior brought him to America. And then, and to be honest, Thunderdome, he didn't need to do Thunderdome. And he did it as a favor to George Miller, because at that time, I mean, he had the Lethal Weapon films. He could done anything he wanted to, and he did Beyond Thunderdome at a cut rate. So that's why I think that he might have probably would have gone forward.
Yeah,
I mean, as far as what you're saying, Chad, I mean, I knew that George Miller was attached and that basically it was it's done with Australian money and it's going to be an Australian film, that kind of set me at ease. I was kind of worried that it was going to be American money and American studios being putting their all into it. But George Miller is very, very clever, because when he does a film, even if it is with American money, he does it in Australia because he knows that none of those people want to travel 24 hours to go and see him. So he's very clever. Yeah.
My biggest concern was also too, is that it would be overly CGI'd. It just didn't feel that way. You could tell that they obviously use filters to set the tone, but it was nice to be like, I just know from a budgeting standpoint, everything blowing up and the Cirque du Soleil of people like doing the acrobats and all. I mean, it was so well done that way, where I just wasn't like, I wouldn't be like, oh, because my friend said in the beginning, when they're in the desert, he's like, oh, look at all the CGI, I'm like, and that's about all you get. Like, where the dam and all that, that's all CGI. But after that, it just feels natural. It feels like you're in the desert with them,
I'm sorry, the Fast and the Furious franchise has ruined vehicular movies for me. There is so much CGI and just nonsense in those that was another reason I was scared to see this film. I'm like, okay, this is going to kill my childhood, because this is going to be just CGI Americanized modern madness in hopes that maybe it could prey off my 80s nostalgia. You know, there was so much holding me back from watching this movie the first time. And then I remember when I finally sat down to watch it, I'm like, what the hell did I just see?
I know. It's one of those that should be seen on a big screen. I agree.
Well, there's not a hell of a lot of CGI used in this film, surprisingly enough. All the people that you're seeing and all the crowds are real people. They didn't filter them out with CGI. All the vehicles that you're seeing are vehicles that do run. They made all those vehicles and they do run. That guy with the guitar flashing, that's real fire that's coming out. That's not CGI fire.
That is so awesome.
Yeah.
And George Miller wanted to bridge the gap between the first movies and this movie as far as technical advances go. And the reason why that in the desert in the beginning is CGI'd a little bit. They had to get, what happened was is they had a downfall of water, and that desert ended up being full of wildflowers. So they actually had to CGI the wildflowers out.
Oh, interesting. To make it look more disparaging, basically.
Yeah,
yeah, because if the guy was crawling out of the hole, who had no legs, is crawling out of the hole, and there's wildflowers, it could ruin that moment there. So yeah. I remember seeing that going, Jesus, like when he comes crawling out,
I mean, I have to give extra kudos to Tom Hardy for putting on Mel Gibson's accent as well.
Right.
Tom Hardy is an East End English boy. If you ever hear him talking normally, he doesn't sound like that.
Yeah.
And he does very, very well. Because Mel Gibson's accent and voice are kind of hard to put, because even though he has that Australian, but there's this baritone richness to his voice that I've never seen anyone been able to mimic his voice ever in anything. So yeah. For Tom Hardy to pull that off, that's quite a, kudos to him. And to be honest, I think Tom Hardy, as far as I don't know what he's like in the rest of the world, but in the UK, Tom Hardy does bedtime stories on BBC children's programming here. He does about three a year to reach children. And it's basically got the highest ratings of any BBC programming of all time due to housewives going in and creaming their knickers while he's reading their children a bedtime story. So, yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
More green eggs and ham. Tell me, Daddy. Yeah. Tell me, Daddy Brady.
Yeah, it's a bit like that, actually. Yeah.
I read that it was actually Heath Ledger was up for the role, and then that's when he had passed. So that would have been interesting to have that take, keeping that person in mind who could have been him.
Yeah, I kind of prefer Tom Hardy in this role. I'm a bit. There's another two films coming out with the Mad Max character to tell the rest of his story. And then, of course, Furiosa is getting her spin-off story. So doing Furiosa, then they're doing the Mad Max, another Furiosa and a Mad Max. So we got like two trilogies going to be running at the same time.
Now, haven't they recast Theron? Haven't they recast her as Furiosa, though?
It's going to be version. Anya, who is in The Witch, which we covered.
Oh,
I'm curious because I think it's going to be holy her story. Hell. How she becomes Furiosa.
So the girl from what's the chess series on Split. Netflix?
Oh yeah, she's also in Split as well.
Yeah,
the Queen's Gambit.
Yes,
there we go. Oh wow, that's gonna be her, huh?
So it's gonna. I think it's just gonna be how she, because remember she got taken from her home and then was brought there, but it's probably how she becomes Furiosa. Basically.
Okay. Oh yeah. All in. 100% all in.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to see how Furiosa's eyes go from one side of her head to back to the center. So that'd be quite good. Because I like Anya Taylor, what's her name? But she does kind of look like a bit of a goldfish because she has like those great big eyes and kind of on the other side of her face.
Yeah.
So I think another good thing that we have is that George Miller is not going to let anyone do this. He's sticking to it, and he's sticking to the gun.
That's great.
I think the difference between Fury Road and the other three Mad Max films is the guy who wrote them before died, and so he spent a really good time finding people who could continue the story and work with him and be able to work in this universe. And I think he found a good team there.
Yeah, I mean it's written so well. I mean Fury Road, the just the plot of it and how it moves along and the themes of home, right? Because it's like, you know, Furiosa was taken from her home, and then, you know, this mad king wants to keep these brides, and they're looking for a new home, and there's all these different themes that are intertwined. And I think the writing for it was so well done, because I didn't find myself ever going, oh, that's not believable. Even what was his name? Nux falling for one of them and having that relationship. I kind of felt I knew where it was going, but it was so authentic and it felt authentic. And even the relationship between Furiosa and Max, it held this grudge between each other. And the only way they relieved it was at the very end when he was like, see you later, you know, and she's going up and he's staying there. I think she finally was like, okay, you're a cool dude, right? You helped me get here and you got me to this place.
I think another good thing with George Miller and the way that he does his films, that he does make message films. All his films have a message. You know, this one's got a lot of messages in it. And it's probably the only feminist film that you'll see that they're not hitting you over the head with this feminism storyline going through that, you know. And I have to sit there and say that's quite clever, because a lot of Hollywood films are trying to come out with some whatever political message they're trying to sell.
Yeah.
Whether you know believe in them or not, sometimes it is like being sledgehammer over the head to the point where it's just like, okay, well now you're just pointing your finger and yelling at me. Where George Miller kind of just wraps it all up and sort of thing, and then you walk away with it and you start thinking about it. It's like, oh, okay, it's this. Oh, now it's this and this. Okay, it's environmental. Oh, it's this. Yeah. And I think it takes a really strong director and a really strong scriptwriters to be able to do that. And I think sometimes that what we have of late is kind of a little bit of weakness in that sort of thing, because, you know, you tend to, if whatever message you're trying to portray and whatever you have out there, it's best to sit there and make it subliminal. So therefore it hits you without it overpowering you. And a lot of times, you know, whether it's the Ghostbusters, the female Ghostbusters, that was hammering you overhead with this feminism thing sort of thing. And I think, you know, if they didn't, and at one point, I think they kind of turn to the camera and tell you sort of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think there's been a couple shows that we've had, you know, over the years that kind of have been hammering you over the head or whatever like this, where he just goes, I'm going to let the characters breathe on the screen and they'll tell you their story. And what take away from it is up to you. But you do, but he does get his message across. Yeah. I mean, even if you look at something as silly as Happy Feet. Sort of thing. That there's an environmental message all the way through that film, but you're not hammered over the head with this environmental message at all. Not at one time. Not at one point. Neither are you with Babe with the message that he has through there about, you know, the cruelty to farm animals and what's happening there and all the other stuff that goes along in the messages that you get with this. But he doesn't give you that. You get it afterwards once you like sit about it and you think back. All right. But you always sit back going, I saw a really great film. I actually learned something today, sort of thing. But it's not like it's not like you learn something first and then, and hopefully you'll enjoy it. It's you'll enjoy the film. And if you learn something great, if you don't, you're still going to have a good ride on the way there.
Yeah. There's also with this one too, you think that there is a happy ending, but then not really. Cause you look at it, it's an enslaved society in general. Like you have that, like she, that yes, she has now killed the king and now she is the, you know, the queen and all that, but she's now going to have to protect that. Right. And then you have all these other factions who are vying for things, but you have, well, what do you do with the people at the bottom who are still, you know, they're going to be there. And that's not going to be like, so it's something that you watch and afterwards I was like, oh, she, you know, she wins. And I'm like, but in this world, no one's really winning. Like literally all of them are going to be doing is, oh, like, you know, one of the biggest moments of this film, it was gut wrenching is when she is reunited with her family. And she's like at the green place, I'm bringing him to the green place. And they're like, oh, you passed it. And she's like, what? And then, I was like, oh my God. And I was like, the tree. And then I was like, oh, the tree. And then she just has this defeated moment where she just collapses and she just, you know, starts wailing. It is such a, like, this is a tough world to live in. And, you know, we can keep going in a direction, but we don't know what's that way. But I guess we should, because what's the alternative, right? So it's very, you're left with this sort of, like, hopelessness, because even though they bring them back, someone's going to find out that change of power and position and is going to want to try to take that from her now, right? So there's a story there that's about constantly trying to keep up with, you know, being a ruler and trying to protect the people and how do you bring the people from the bottom up. And like, it's, so it's all that was like resonating for me, because it's like, you know, we live in a world where it's like money is power. Like this isn't money, this is water, bullets and gas are the three drivers, right? That's so crazy. And that this faction controls this and this faction controls that, and they're driving everything.
Well, I mean, I guess you could sit there and say the same thing as, like, you know, if you look at the American election sort of thing, and, you know, I don't care what side you're on here, but whoever won, you know, in your case, Biden, whoever won, who was going to win that election kind of lost anyway, because the next 4 years, you're going to go through hell. You're going to have to rebuild everything. So it doesn't matter, you know, who won. It's like, you know, and to be honest, who, you know, who's ever going to run these. You know, I mean, we know who's going to run these 4 years, but it'll be interesting. I mean, he's not going to be sitting, but at the end of it, because it's going to take 8 to 12 years to bring everything back after the whole COVID thing, that person is going to go down as one of the worst presidents, doesn't matter who's in. Like, they could be Einstein sorting everything out, because, and that's the same thing what you're saying with her, because the thing is, like, she's going to have to restructure the society. And to be honest, not everyone's going to be rising to the top. Not everyone's cream at the end
loyal,
of the day.
Right? Yeah.
And there's going to be people
fighting it. Well, I'm also going to say, like, he had other sons, I guess, sons or daughters, right? That I'm sure one of them is going to be like, oh, I don't, you know, you killed my dad, right? Wouldn't you? I'd be like, who are you? You know, you're at a very high spot.
But she's also got that. She's also got all those young guys who are on drugs. So she's going to have to sort them out as well. Yeah. You know, the ones that are snorting the whole thing. So,
oh, I know. Yeah, well, then you get into religion, right, too, as well. This cultism, a belief of like, you know, so that was another resonating sort of like factor with you get these crazy evangelicalists, like people who they get sucked into a belief. And so these people who are literally, my one friend was like, what is he doing? I'm like, he's doing what some people do in real life, which is a suicide bomber. Like he literally was like, I'm giving my life up. I'm going to Valhalla. And he was literally, and my friend was like, no, he's not. I'm like, oh yes, he is. I'm like, oh yes, he is. He's filling that car with octane and gas and he's going to blow himself up, you know? And that's a reality, right? That's something that people do, and they get wrapped, and their minds get wrapped into that occult.
You know? Well, that's what you also find with the breakdown of society is people become more disenfranchised about what's around them. They tend to turn to whatever religion or God they're praying to.
Yeah,
and they tend to go from one extreme to another. When things are good, people become atheists. I think the thing is when things become atheists, when things go, people go back to God, sort of thing. And,
I spent many years working in law enforcement, and a lot of that time was spent working in corrections in both a county and a federal jail. And everybody is handed a Bible when they're arrested and brought in. And a lot of them will talk nothing but religion the whole time that they're incarcerated. But those Bibles are recycled out of the garbage when they're on their way out.
It's also like you got to show truth to character in order to be able to be like, oh, maybe I'll get a shorter term. I totally believe. Yeah, whatever verse you say.
Well, I mean, look at Tex Watson. I mean, isn't he a pastor now? And to be honest, I mean, he Charlie, I don't think actually murdered anyone, but Tex Watson's the one that actually did the most brutal killing of them all, sort of thing. But I think most serial killers turn to religion anyway for some reason.
Yeah,
and mass murderers and stuff like that. But I mean, the thing is, you do find that in society anyway. I mean, if you look at when times are financially really hard, you'll find that cults start growing, and where people become like the 80s, cults were a really big thing. Late 70s into the 80s until before the yuppies took over. That's when cults were like on a high rise, because in the 70s, times were really hard. I mean, I think people forget that they think of disco music, but everyone was poor in the 70s. And that's when Jonestown and all these cults started rising to the foreground.
We're seeing it again now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we had the recession too. So we had around that time is when you see things start to bubble up too. When it's a signs of desperation, you look for a higher power, right, to give you direction.
Well, I mean, I think you can mention social media as kind of a cult as well, sort of thing. I mean, people get involved, they'll start to little, boards now. I mean, what's quite great is that people can become part of a cult with actually leaving their house nowadays, and they'll start the little boards, and then of course they'll have this ringleader who pretty much dictates what all his followers are thinking and believing.
And
it's hive mentality, isn't it? It's like, who's the queen of this hive, and this is what this hive's thinking over here, and this is what this hive's thinking. And then and eventually, of course, they're all thinking they're praying to the big one, when in all actuality they're praying, they're all going for the same thing, but doing it in a different way, sort of thing, without actually looking at the differences. But
I'd like to say that I can't relate, but I remember when I first enlisted to the Army many, many moons ago, just growing up, being totally fed up with religion. My parents were really big into church. Like, we were there every time the doors were open. It was like that old commercial they would play for Black Friday where the lady is at like the department store and she's just going open, open, open. We were like, we were like that, or my parents were like that. And, by proxy, we were too, because they had the car and they told us what to do. But when I got into the Army, I was my own man. I was out on my own and just miserable as hell, because I had drunkenly, because drugs are illegal in America, drunkenly decided to go into the military. And that very first Sunday, when they asked, all right, who wants to go to church? And I sat there and I thought for a second, God, I hate church. But if there's anybody that can get me out of this situation, it's God. So I went.
thinking, no, get me out.
But that was also the last time, other than for a wedding or a funeral, that I ever went to church, because the preacher was preaching a sermon about how God wanted us to follow the orders of the superior officers placed above us, even if that meant marching to our own death. And I'm like, wow, this church sucks. I'm not coming back.
Literally, is that where the term marching order comes from? Yeah. Literally.
I mean, the thing is, personally, I don't mind spirituality. I have a problem with people who follow religion. They haven't actually read the manual.
Right. So yes.
You know, it's a bit like buying a new stereo and not reading the manual. So you never know exactly what that stereo does. And then someone comes over and tells you what that stereo does, but you don't know if they're telling you the truth or not. Yeah. But if you read the manual, you'll be able to get everything that you need to get out of it, sort of thing. And you come up with your own conclusions. I think that's what bothers me about religion. You got a lot of people who follow it who've never actually read the manual. And that's what my problem
is. Oh, it's not that it's a lot of them. It's most of them.
Yeah, they pick and choose what to use from that device. They're like, oh, we'll pick this component. The tape cassette is great, but it also has a record player. No, it doesn't. Yeah. It only has a tape player. Pretty sorry.
Well,
hey, what about this part where it says that if you rape a woman but pay her father 50 shekels, then everything's square?
That's not a thing?
I'm telling you what's in there.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I mean, that's what's quite funny about...
I've got 50 shekels right now.
That seems like a really interesting thing about the Christian side of thing, because it's like they'll quote, it's like I only pray to the New Testament, and it's like in the New Testament, if you do read it, it's quite, you know, it's all quite love and beauty, and Jesus doesn't really condemn hardly anything in it whatsoever. But when they are condemning, they're always going to Leviticus, which has like the shackles, women who are widowed needs to be stoned, and all this other stuff. It's like, you know, it's like they tend to pick and choose out of Leviticus. It's like, well, you know, if you're gonna pray out of one thing of Leviticus, you might want to do it all. You might as well. You can't really pick and choose.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's always quite funny. And you can always pull people up. If you ever want to have a discussion or a debate about religion, read up on your Leviticus and just basically just quote this stuff at them. And they're like, who? They go, well, it's actually Leviticus chapter 3, verse 6. You know, it's like, and it kind of like shuts them up for a little while. They don't know what to say. And I always find that, you know, there's always two questions when anyone comes religious knocking on my door, and I just go, if incest is so bad, if Adam and Eve are on earth and Adam and Eve have Cain, Abel, and Seth, Cain slays Abel, leaving Adam, Eve, Cain, and Seth on face, and Cain ran off with his wife, did he run off with his mother? And if incest is so bad, how did Noah and his family repopulate the world?
Well, and it's funny because I was literally just talking to my friend about this the other day. I'm like, so there has to be this moment where the people of religion would go, wait, there's only a man and a woman, and they have kids. So how did they have other kids?
And they only had male children.
And they only had male, right? So then it's like,
I can't imagine if incest would be an actual day-to-day thing, though, because kids can't even get along when it's playtime. How in the hell are they going to get along during that, too? Mom, Joey said he was going to give me an orgasm, and he didn't.
So in this film, you wonder, too, the wives, beyond them being these women who are probably used and abused and all that, you wonder if they were his daughters, right? So you wonder if they were the mothers who are the milking mothers with the big things, whatever. You wonder if they had them, and he's like, great, that's my daughter. Now she's going to be my wife, right? You're like, whoa, you know?
And in that society, he could decide that. He could just,
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, I mean, when you go to Old Testament Bible, I mean, they all had multiple wives, didn't they? I mean, they're all, you know, there wasn't the problem back then of, you know, courting inside your family. It kept the family bound stronger, kept the family line stronger. Though, you know, you may have children with one eye looking at you and another eye looking for you, but your bloodline is stronger.
No, every single one of those girls were a supermodel. So,
I also want to say it's probably because he controls all the crops, and then the mother's milk is like milk. It's not like tainted, right? So I think it's like he was trying to breed the perfect, you know, people, a perfect race of people. His sons were like giant steroid driven, you know, sons, except for the one that was in the little floating chair thingy.
yeah
He, poor guy. You know, it was like, oh, dad. I was like, how are you? What? What's going on? You're dad and he's dad. Like, what?
Now, I may be mistaken, but I think in Road Warrior, I think between Mad Max and Road Warrior that there has been some kind of nuclear war at some point, fallout. Because the thing is I think you start seeing like a lot of Thunderdome, you see a lot of people who are kind of malformed.
Yeah,
and mutated. Like, mutated. And and you see a lot more of it in Fury Road, and you do see some of it in Road Warrior as well.
Well, you also see that firestorm thing. That's not natural weather. Like, that is like nuclear like weather, where you're seeing like a firestorm, like, which, you know, again, suspending my disbelief, they go through that whole thing and then they just make their way back through that. Like what happened to that? Did that just move on? Like, where did that go? Like, and my friend was like, but it took him like 2 days. I'm like, yeah, just don't even think about that. it took him a day. They're good. You know, they got there, you know.
Well, when you see how malformed the people were, and then you realize how scarce water is, hygienically, that cannot be the most hygienic population.
Yeah. They're like, so that, walking, that could lead to a lot of
that too.
Mm. Well, I mean, like that old mother, I mean, she's, you know, in this time period, you know, she's probably only like 40. Because they think about people who are probably not living that long, really. If they're that malnourished and everything going wrong, I mean, cancer's probably rike. That during that.
Every disease probably is. I mean, that's the thing when you think about it. Oh my God, there's got to be just so many different diseases going through that population in Fury Road.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
yeah.
Well, it's like when I was watching, I finished watching The Stand recently, and I watched that, the new version of that, which is interesting. Well, I think you can pretty much skip chapter 9, but everything, it's okay. It's interesting. But I always thought to myself, I was like, the thing is, you kind of need a good dentist, because if you don't have a good dentist, people start dying from tooth decay.
Oh, yeah.
You can die from tooth decay. Yeah. You get sepsis and stuff like that. So I always, I was kind of wondering that, like, in The Stand, it's like, oh, they don't have a dentist. So they're probably all going to die from tooth decay.
Did you hear that they're actually creating an alternate ending to that? I think it's supposed to be released in a couple of weeks. And Stephen King wrote it. So he actually, he actually altered an ending to one of his works.
Well, the ending that they have at the moment, I'm not giving anything away, but it's very wanky, very self-indulgent. It's like, I thought that was it, to be honest. I'm like, what in the hell did they do here?
And, no, this is about a character who was supposed to be a part of the group that goes to fight, and she either dies or something happens, but he rewrites it. So he rewrites a character that should have been with this team of people.
You know what I have problems with The Stand? It's always bothered me, whether it's the first one or the second one, is that if you have a disease that takes 3 to 4 days to kill you off, how come you end up like drowning in your soup? And how come you're just out in the street? Don't you just die at home?
I know.
Feel that rough.
Yeah. And I was going to say, if you knew that was happening, I'd be like, you would find me with a video game controller in my hands. I'd be doing whatever the hell is making me happy to die. I'd be like this. You know, like,
I'd be choking on my own mucus in my bed with my duvet over my head. I know that's how I would die. I just would be, I'm like, oh, ooh, cream and mushroom soup. I don't think I'd be eating that. I don't know. No. I mean, if you have a mucus, soup is not the one that you want. You know, might be a can of Coke or something.
These post-apocalyptic films, I don't think anyone ever really tackles the smell. Can you? I mean, you just.
Oh, yeah.
Just, you know, between people going to the bathroom everywhere, no one bathing, just everybody's in a tight little vehicle on these road trips. And not once did one of those characters turn to the other and just go like sniff them, you know, like either or they're just used to it by now.
Or they're huffing. So that's why they're huffing the paint. That's why
they get
lots of smell.
I always wonder that when I see some of these, like, you know, whether it's night films from, you know, Knights of the Round Table, or if it's a Western or something like this, and like, you know, those people all smelled really bad.
Oh yeah.
And then it's like, and then they're like, you know, they go, oh, let's go rape this woman. It's like, okay.
Like, I just went, you know, we're talking about the great 2021 Texas snowpocalypse. I just went 3 days with no power and no water. And when everything finally came back on last night and I went to go take the inevitable shower, I smelled horrible after 3 days.
I know.
It's funny how people complain too without having hot water. And thankfully, my dad taught me at a very young age when I went to go see my grandparents. They were hot water, like they treated it like it was the apocalypse. They kept that water. And if you ran out of water, my grandpa was like, sorry, cold shower. And I remember my dad just throwing me in there going, you got to take a shower, and being like just drenched with, you know, freezing water. And like my friends, when I think here in the city, when we had the flooding, people didn't have hot water. And I was like, I get used to it. Like now I take colder showers. I'm like, why? I'm like, because you don't want to take a shower. Are you kidding me? You would rather not take a shower than take a cold shower? What, are you crazy? Like,
and you never know when the apocalypse is going to happen.
Exactly. Yeah.
I had sat there in St. Fury Road. I didn't see one toilet, so I don't know where these people were going.
Oh, I think in the hole where that guy crawled out of. That's where the poor guy.
Ooh. Or in the fresh water. That's what they do in the Ganges. It's kind of when I went to India once. It's like in the Ganges, and everyone's like bathing it because it's healing. It's like, and like not even like 100 yards up the road is where they're putting the dead. And you're like,
oh yeah, that's safe.
It's not bringing the dead. It's like if it's not bringing the dead back alive, I'm not going in there for healing power. I'm sorry. No. People are drinking out of it, getting their water, filling up their jugs. Like, okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, even look at the clean water when they're dumping those on people. I mean, it's not clean. It is. It's mud water, isn't it? It's like drinking out of a puddle.
Yeah. Well, in this, again, they make the water that's up near where they are all clear and pretty. And then by the time it gets down to them, it's like mud.
And all their dirty, unwashed bodies are like in it, like grabbing water.
Oh, I know.
So basically, it's like, you know, you're just collecting unwashed body water.
Oh my God! You know, that's one of those things that my father used to talk about when I was a kid. Because you know, you go to the amusement park, and they always have the water ride that makes the big splash, and you see the people that's like stand up on the bridge or whatever, so the water will go over them. And my father, from a very, very early age, would tell me and my brothers, be like, don't go stand on that bridge, because that is collected water from everyone's crotch that has been going over
the bathrooms. They're like, oh yeah.
Yeah. They're like, don't go stand. We don't do water rides. And still to this day, I don't do water rides because my father's words echo in my head that it's nothing but crotch water soup and you're just riding around in it.
Well, by the way, it must be because you can clearly smell it's like pumped with chlorine. Like you smell that chlorine and you're like, good Lord. It's like they emptied a whole freaking Clorox bottle into the, you know.
No. We have Six Flags over Texas is right down the road. And no, I have not ridden a water ride probably since early childhood.
Well, I mean, nowadays they put that special chlorine in the pool so you can tell where someone...
Oh, God. Ew. It's like turned purple or something? Like what?
Yeah, like a purple pink. It's like, you know, first thing in the morning is like clear water. By the afternoon, it's like you pretty much got like, you know...
You look like a smart...
Well, you get like art classes, isn't it? Like when you used to mix your colors.
It's like a Rocher. What is it called? With the ink blot?
Oh, Warshak.
Warshak.
A bit like that.
What do you see? I see nothing, mommy. I see someone who peed in the pool. I mean, or did worse. Definitely.
Well, people are a disgusting animal, really, aren't they? Let's be honest. At least cats cover it up. People
are
out there for everyone to walk into. But, so I think what we should do, I think we've pretty much exhausted this conversation. Let's talk about
and gross everyone out. Sorry about that.
What are your final thoughts of Mad Max and Mad Max Fury Road, starting with John?
It took me a little bit to get in the first one. I'm glad that I did see it because I hadn't seen it, and I was always a dry. I'm going to see 2 and 3. Loved Fury Road. I mean, it's just very badass. It's very, you know, very well done from the filming, from the music, from just I love a film that just keeps you like constantly engaged, and it wasn't like I ever got bored. in this reality that we live in now, it's very easy to pick up your phone. And like, I was in this film and like watching it, and it goes by quick. It feels like it doesn't like at first. And then you're like, oh my God, we're already like an hour and a half into this. It just goes so fast, you know? Loved it, loved it, loved it.
What about yourself, Chad? What are your final thoughts on these two films?
Well, both of these films, well, all four films in the Mad Max universe, they're all kind of their own thing, really. And if you go in order from how they were released, I think you're going to have the best experience because of the differences between, you know, how like the original Mad Max is like mini Mad Max compared to Fury Road. And it's like a stair step in both quality and story. And I'd say my recommendation to anyone who has not watched these movies before would be to watch them in the order of release, because the older ones in the series are, they're not going to hold your attention. Once you've seen Fury Road, I don't think any of the other three will be able to hold your attention as well.
What about yourself, Joe?
Well, the original Mad Max, just historically created like I don't know if it created it, but it certainly spun off into all these ripoffs. It basically made the post-apocalyptic subgenre of the early 80s. So it's a trendsetter. It's an important piece of cinema history just in that. Without it, you don't have a lot of the post-apocalyptic movies that came out in the 80s. Earlier, Keith mentioned RoboCop, which is kind of the other side of the same coin here, which is the breakdown of society. Only in RoboCop, you have the corporations come in and take over. Mad Max, it's a world where just everything breaks down, nothing takes over, and everything just goes to hell. Fury Road, in a time period where, like Chad was saying earlier, we're getting all these movies that are just nostalgia pieces that are they do kind of feel like ripoffs in a way. They do kind of feel like they're kind of playing on our nostalgia, but then not delivering. This movie, on the other hand, does something completely. It is the next step in the progression. It uses the technology to make a far better film than I think George Miller ever expected to be able to make. And I think also, like Keith said, because it was made in Australia, you know, with Australian money, and George Miller just basically auteured the whole thing, it kind of shows the studios that, dude, just shut the fuck up and let these guys do their thing. Let these filmmakers who know what they're doing make their film their way, because the film was not only a hit, it's a great movie. If you leave these guys to their devices for the most part and not interfere and try to micromanage them on every level, you could have 10 movies on the level of Fury Road every year. Just give these guys a chance to make their movie their way. And we don't get that anymore. This shows that if you give these great filmmakers that opportunity, they can deliver something on that level that just fires on all cylinders. And the other thing John mentioned earlier, the movie is nonstop action. I watched the documentary that accompanied what was it called? I forget what it was called. One of the documentaries that's on iTunes on it. The test audiences actually complained that there was too much action and they didn't have a chance to breathe in between. So I thought that was kind of that's kind of an interesting thing too. But it's fantastic storytelling, and it's something that you don't really see in these big budget movies anymore, because you get like 12 producers in there that come in and go, well, we need this to satisfy this market, and we need this and this and this to satisfy this. Just let them go, man. Let them make their movies, because these guys are fantastic. They've been making movies for 40, 50 years. They know what they're doing. Let them go.
Yeah. They also did this in black and white, which I would love to see. Like, they have not released that. I would love to see it.
Oh, they did release it.
It's released. It's on Vudu. It's on Vudu. I believe it's on Vudu.
Yeah, cool. It's available on the DVD, but they forgot to include it on the Blu-ray. So there is talk about this being rectified at some point. Sort of thing. My final thoughts are basically of Mad Max is that I think I love Mad Max. I'm a big fan of these small independent films that came out in the 80s. There's this, there's Repo Man. There is the Brother from Another Planet that was around about this time. Liquid Sky is another one of my favorite. And I quite like these small independent films who basically we're going to do it the guerrilla style and out we come, and they come out with a great project. And I like the idea that, you know, this is the beginning of Mad Max and you see how it comes. And I like the idea that it's like homegrown version of Mad Max. It's not an overblown thing where he's like some kind of superhero that gets bit by a meteor or whatever like this. He's kind of like, you know, this is like a normal man of every day. And then as you go through the films, you see him become the person he is in Fury Road. And I know that we're jumping from one to the end here. But I quite like the way that George Miller has been able to take this character and grow him at the same time, but keep him in legendary comic book mythology. And I like the mythology that is built around Mad Max, that, you know, he is a normal person who unfortunately, you know, was dealt a hard, you know, hard blow with the loss. And this is what happens when you go through a loss. And then he's a man with basically on his lonesome, basically. And that's what you get through the rest of the films. But at the same time, he's a man with no humanity, but a lot of humanity underneath it all. And that's what I quite like about him. He's not like, you know, because whenever anyone needs a helping hand, he's always there.
Yeah,
you know, he's always there to help, you know, the underdog sort of thing. And at the end of the day, he doesn't want to be thanked either. He's like, I don't thank me. I'll help you. And I'm going on my way. And I quite like that. There never has to be any kind of retribution for Mad Max as well. And I quite like that he doesn't need the retribution. We don't need this, you know, this character arc where it's just like, oh, he's a new man. He's going to be a new person after all this is over with. He's just living his life, going from, you know, story to story.
Trying to get by.
Yeah. And what I like about Fury Road is simple fact that it's able to carry that legend forward. And even though it has lost a major scriptwriter and lost Mel Gibson per se due to age and various other reasons, it hasn't lost any of its punch or fight and the mythology and everything is still there. And the only thing that I have against Fury Road is that I watched Fury Road and I was a huge fan of the Chronicles of Riddick film, where I thought this was going to be great, and I look at, when I see Mad Max Fury Road, I look at Chronicles of Riddick like, that's the movie that movie should have been, sort of thing, when basically when Hollywood Studios got involved and messed it all up, and we got this shit movie, which could have been a fantastic movie. We're here, we got the studios leaving this alone, as Joe said, and we got this fantastic movie. And it does make me excited to see where he will go with it, because I think with George, what I like about George Miller is that he's true to his vision. He fights with his vision, but at the same time, he's not a director who demands a lot of money. He only does he does passion projects that he wants to do, and the money that's spent on any of his films you will see on the screen is not going to be put into his pocket. He's not a vanity. He's not the director. And that's what I like about George Miller, and you see that in Fury Road. Fury Road did not cost that much to make.
Yeah, which is surprising because, again, the cars and the blowing up and all that, like the pyrotechnics and all that, like you would think it costs a lot of money, you know?
I mean, surprisingly enough, I think the budget is the budget was $154.6 million. And it grossed $375.4 million. Wow. And they still didn't think they made enough money on this.
And basically kickstarted the franchise again too, because it was it was a dying franchise. And to, you know, Chad's point, at one point, because you see it, you're like, oh God, are they going to rebrand? Are they going to redo it, reimagine it? And you get, you get that. Or you get people who don't even know the franchise are like, oh, I don't really know Mad Max, so maybe I shouldn't watch it because it's not going to make sense. But it's amazing how it pulled in the people who were the fans and then pulled in new people to watch it too as well.
Another thing I would suggest that, Joe.
Well, I was going to say. You go ahead, Keith. I'm gonna shut up.
Well, I was going to sit there and say about George Miller also is I suggest that if you do like the Mad Max films, you should really experience some other George Miller films as well. Picnic at Hanging Rock, which is a classic Australian film about true story about how these girls went on a picnic and they disappeared during the Victorian era. No one knows what happened to them to this very day.
What is it called again?
Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Okay.
There's also Gallipoli. If you want to see one of the best war films ever. There's that as well. And of course, the Mad Max. And I mean, even though we do smile and smirk at Happy Feet and Babe, they're fantastic films as well.
Yeah.
And
yeah, they are.
And that's what I, you know, that's another thing I'd say about George Miller is that he's true to his form. And that's, anything that he comes out, I will watch. And if he stays true to his word, I mean, he's getting on in age now and he's still pumping it out. I think that the only time I would stop watching any of these films of these Mad Max ilk is something happens and he should pass on and he stops doing them. And yeah. Then someone else takes over it. And then I think that's probably when I would probably pull out.
Yeah. After today's double high octane episode, we hope you have reached your max of listening jubilation. But if you still have road rage and need a little more nitro, head on over to our website at llpodcast.com to check out all of our social and podcast platforms, listen to all of our past episodes, become a patron, and sign up for our monthly newsletter to read our reviews of books to screen and everything in between. For our next episode, the team will be continuing their soapy supernatural road trip review of the Dark Shadow series. As always, we'd like to thank you for downloading, liking, and sharing the Literary License podcast. Until next time, buckle up and stay safe out there, folks. Bye.
Yeah, Breaker 19, this here's a rubber duck. You got a copy on me, Big Ben? Come on. Yeah, 10-4, Big Ben, for sure, for sure. By golly, it's clean, clear to Flagtown. Come on. Yeah, it's a big 10-4 there, Big Ben. Yeah, we definitely got the front door, good buddy. Mercy sakes alive, looks like we got us a convoy.
It was the dark of the moon on the 6th of June in a Kenworth pulling logs. Cab over Pete with a reefer on and a Jimmy hauling hogs. We is heading for Bear on I-10 about a mile out of Shaky Town. I says, Pigpen, this here's a rubber duck and I'm about to put the hammer down.
Cause we got little
back off them hogs. Good, 10-4, about 5 miles or so. 10, roger, them hogs is getting intense up here.
By the time we got into Tulsa Town, we had 85 trucks in all. But there's a roadblock up on the Cloverleaf, and them bears is wall to wall. Yeah, them smokies as thick as bugs on a bumper. They even had a bear in the air. I says, calling all trucks, this here is the duck. We about to go a-hunting bear.
Cause we got a great big convoy.
Big Ben. Negatory, Big Ben. You're still too close. Yeah, them hogs are starting to close up my sinuses. Mercy sakes, you better back off another 10.
Well, we rolled up Interstate 44 like a rocket sled on rails. We tore up all of our swindle sheets and left them setting on the scales. By the time we hit that shy town, them bears was getting smart. They'd brought up some reinforcements from the Illinois National Guard. There's armored cars and tanks and jeeps and rigs of every size. Yeah, them chicken coops was full of bears and choppers filled the skies. Well, we shot the line, we went for broke with 1,000 screaming trucks and 11 long-haired friends of Jesus in a chartreuse microbus.
Yeah, rubber duck to Sodbuster. Come on there, yeah. 10-4, Sodbuster. Listen, you want to put that microbus in behind that suicide jockey? Yeah, he's hauling dynamite. He needs all the help he can get.
Well, we laid a strip for the Jersey Shore and prepared to cross the line. I could see the bridge was lined with bears, but it didn't have a doggone dime. I says, Pigpen, this here's a rubber duck. We just ain't going to pay no toll. So we crashed the gate doing 98. I says, let them truckers roll 10-4.
Cause we got a mighty convoy rocking through the night. Yeah, we got a mighty convoy. Ain't she a beautiful sight? I want to join our convoy. Ain't nothing going to get my way. We're going to roll this truckin' convoy. Cause we can't say. Convoy.
y'all know what's been in them honks out there for sure. Well, mercy sakes, good buddy, we're going to back on